This is KHOI Community Radio's Local Talk Wednesday edition of COVID-19 Response. I am one of your hosts for today, Pat Schlarbaum, together with my co-host, Susan Franson. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. And I'm especially happy to be here with you today because everything about this program relates to our relationship to the land and the people who struggle to protect it. You personally joined with these people during the past several years in the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline. So you're the perfect person to interview our guests.
Well, I appreciate that, Susan. But the pipeline has been in operation for almost 3 years, since June of 2017. So what's today's story, Susan?
Well, I recently saw an article in The Guardian, and it mentions elsewhere, announcing a new legal decision on the pipeline. I'll read from a first couple of paragraphs of that article. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was ordered to conduct a full environmental impact statement after the Washington, D.C. court ruled that existing permits violated the National Environmental Protection Act. The ruling is a huge victory for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe of North Dakota, which rallied support from across the world and sued the U.S. government in a campaign to stop an environmentally risky pipeline being built on tribal lands. After years of commitment to defending our water and earth, we welcome this news of a significant legal win, said Tribal Chairman Mike Faith. It's humbling to see how actions we took to defend our ancestral homeland continue to inspire national conversations about how our choices ultimately affect this planet.
And yes, Susan, that violation was with the National Environmental Policy Act, and the struggle does go on, and sometimes it's hard to maintain hope, but I guess the things we routinely do, even plant our gardens, make a difference in the way we affect the world. That's what Carolyn Raffensperger with the Science and Environmental Health Network talked about yesterday. And here's Carolyn. Well, how is your day unfolding with this COVID-19 response?
Oh, well, I went out this morning to look at my garden, and I'm planting all sorts of plants, most of which do well in cool weather, thankfully. And I looked in the bed where I had kale and parsley and cilantro, and there was an owl feather right in the middle of the bed.
Oh, you had a visitor.
It was amazing. It is so beautiful. That kind of golden brown and, you know, the bars on it, it just, Yeah, so I felt like I'd been given a gift from the earth.
A gift of the land.
A gift from the sky, yeah, where sky and earth meet.
Yeah, and possibly assisting you with rabbit deterrence.
With any luck, rabbit deterrence.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
The thing that has astonished me in the last 48 hours or so is watching various plants germinate, and the two that have been the most striking to me, one was the potato, and I'm raising a red potato, and red potatoes are wonderful for mashing and things like that. And they send up these leaves that are in a tight rosette, and it is such a beautiful thing to watch coming out of the earth. As interesting or are these beans that I'm raising. And the beans that particularly have captured my imagination and my mind are beans called Aricara yellow beans. And I got them from a seed company that is based in North Dakota.
And the Aricara are a indigenous culture nation?
The Aricara are one of the three affiliated tribes in North Dakota.
Okay.
And the Aricara, Mandan, and Hidatsa are the three tribes that were living just near Bismarck, North Dakota, mm-hmm. when Lewis and Clark went up the Missouri River. They collected some of these seeds. And they have a long tradition in North Dakota these seeds that are, you know, geared towards the unique climate of North Dakota, which has more daylight during the summer. You know, they have longer days, although a shorter growing season. We have a longer growing season, and our days are not quite as long, even in June, as, say, North Dakota. But these seeds, you plant a bean seed in the ground, and then it sends up the shoot, that cotyledon, those leaves.
Oh,
and it unbends, so it has this crook in it, and then it lifts this encasing around these leaves and unfurls above the ground. It is absolutely stunning. And, you know, how many seeds are doing that right now as we speak? And what it brought to mind was something that Rowan White said. Rowan White is a Mohawk woman, an indigenous woman, and she has been president of Seed Savers Exchange, one of the great nonprofit institutions of Iowa that saves heirloom varieties and seeds.
And out of Decorah?
Out of Decorah.
Yeah.
And I was speaking at an indigenous farming conference in Minnesota a couple of years ago where I met Rowan, and I was giving a talk on the law of future generations. And she gave a talk on what the economy should look like. And in this day of the pandemic, we are well aware that the pandemic has not only completely upset and upended public health, but it has completely upended the economy. You know, so many people that I know are out of work, can't pay their bills, are struggling. And the thing that Rowan said was that we needed a seed economy. And she held out a handful of seeds of, I don't know what was in it, squash, corn, beans, held those out in her hand and said, this one handful, she didn't say, she just held it out so that you could see it, and said, this can feed you for your whole life. And so thinking about an economy that would be seed-based rather than, say, money-based, we could still use money, but what if we thought more about the foundation of our well-being in terms of seeds, the garden seeds that we raise food for our consumption and for the eating, you know, for other beings eating, and the wild seeds. If we recognize that our well-being is absolutely based on plants and on seeds, and those seeds are the future generations, they contain the germplasm, the information, the entire library of life coded in those seeds. And so my garden has been an absolutely wondrous place to be, watching a plant unfurl from this little hard nugget of a seed and producing a plant out of earth and water and sun. It is just an astonishing thing. And, we, you know, we've talked before about plants, that I give a plant my breath and the plant gives me its breath. I give carbon dioxide to a plant, which it inhales, and it gives oxygen, which then I breathe. What an extraordinary thing.
Oh, it's reciprocity.
Reciprocity.
At its finest.
And, you know, when we think about restoring the land, you know, you and I have talked a lot about restoring the wild here. And what would it look like if we had the wetlands and the woodlands and the tall grass prairie restored to Iowa? But one of the things that Steve Packard says, and Steve Packard is an environmentalist and ecologist who's done a huge amount to talk about restoration of especially prairies, but he started the Society for Ecological Restoration. And he is one who has really developed the field of restoring prairies, especially around Chicago, and restored some of the biggest prairie areas in the Midwest. And Steve said that if we were going to actually restore the prairie, we would restore the indigenous agriculture as they did it. You know, so many, including the Arikara, planted their wonderful, beautiful seeds near the rivers. And if we restored the same kind of agricultural systems to Iowa, what would that look like here in Iowa? Mm-hmm. We might still raise corn, but what varieties would we raise? How would we prepare them? Yesterday, I made a dinner of a soup, and it had cabbage and potatoes and other things in it. And I had chosen the variety of the potatoes specifically for that soup. Potatoes are native to South America, and the number of varieties of potatoes is vast, as is the kind of varieties of corn. And we raise very few varieties of corn now, and very few varieties of wheat. And yet this wealth, the seed economy that was developed by indigenous cultures, should be a lesson for all of us in how we think about the diversity and the, you know, the foundation of us living on the earth. So, you know, I think about the Arikara having tended those seeds, and that giving rise to a seed company, and now, you know, growing those seeds still today, a couple of hundred years later, after Lewis and Clark discovered them. So I've been thinking about agriculture, restoration, and a seed economy. And if you're thinking about growing a garden this year, I have some advice given the pandemic. We've all experienced food shortages. Go to the grocery store and there may not be flour, there may not be powdered milk, there may not be toilet paper. The basic things that we have always thought would be here have been disrupted. And so as I've planned my vegetable garden, I've been thinking about what would I need to feed my family, my household, in a hard winter. So when I lived in North Dakota, I raised pretty much all of my own food. I raised popcorn and barley and sweet potatoes and dry edible beans, and we had our own cattle, raised our own wheat. We raised it all. And when I moved here to Iowa, my husband was hired to work at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, and I had a good friend come by my house who's a fabulous gardener, and he asked me who owned my yard. Well, we just, you know, paid a lot of money for this house. And I said, you know, we do. And he said, no, who owns this yard? And I looked around and realized that the deer, the raccoons, the opossum, the fox, they actually owned this. I did not. I was co-living with them. And he said that if I tried to garden in the way I had in North Dakota, I would be declaring war on my neighbors. And I had been dedicated to self-sufficiency in North Dakota. I lived 2 miles from my nearest neighbor. They were only there in the summertime. So I had to be self-sufficient. But when I moved to Iowa, I decided to be committed to community sufficiency. And you've heard me say before that a well-fed neighbor is the best defense against hard times. So thinking about how not to declare war on the deer, how to raise food here, what kind of economy would support that, has been the kind of ruminations that I've been doing this week, thinking about community sufficiency, making sure that my neighbor is fed, making sure that the varieties that I raise are a blessing to the land rather than a curse. So it's been an adventure. I do have a garden this year for the first time in a long time, and I do have a fence around it. But I've only taken a small part of my yard, and I am trying to make it as habitable for all the beings that share this with me. Mm-hmm. So those are my thoughts this morning.
Yeah. And you mentioned the 3 squash, corn, and beans. I believe I've heard that referred to as the 3 sisters.
Yeah. And talk about reciprocity. That particular planting community. The beans often climbed the corn and gave nutrients because the beans fix nitrogen. And squash would spread out over an area and, you know, cool the earth and press weeds. So this diet that was based on corn, beans, and squash and lovely varieties of all of them. It was really a tried and true recipe for farming and gardening. And I think it's one of those great lessons that our indigenous friends and neighbors can remind us again of ways to treat the earth even as we raise food.
Well, and I appreciate the inclusion of gardens in our landscape as much as the realization that in a lot of our prairie plantings 30 years ago, I was asked, well, you've got 70, 80, 90 different species of plants in your reconstructed prairie. That's pretty good. But what are you leaving out? And it was the ungulate pressure. It was the action of the buffalo that you didn't hear at that time. And now you kind of do, as far as something that lives, coexists with the prairie, it strengthens the prairie. And if our involvement can strengthen the prairie through gardening, then so be it. In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and we've been listening to Carolyn Raffensperger, Reflections on Our Relations to the Animals Who Make Themselves at Home in Our Gardens. Her mention of indigenous people and buffalo is also a great lead-in to the music we're about to play.
Can you remember the times you have held your head high, told all your friends of your Indian claim? Proud good lady and proud good man, some great-great-grandfather from Indian blood sprang. And you feel in your heart for these ones, oh, it's written in books and in songs. We've been mistreated and wronged. Over and over I hear those same words from you, good lady, and you, good man. But listen to me if you care where we stand, and you feel you're a part of these ones. When a war between nations is lost, the loser we know pays the cost. But even when Germany fell to your hands, consider, dear lady, consider, dear man, you left them their pride and you left them their lands. And what have you done to these ones? Has a change come about, my dear man? Are you still taking our lands? A treaty forever, your senators sign. They do, dear lady, they do, dear man. And the treaties are broken again and again. And what will you do for these ones? Oh, it's all in the past, they will say. But it's still going on here today. The governments now want the Navajo land, than all the Inuit and the Cheyenne. It's here and it's now, you can help us, dear man. Now that the buffalo's gone.
That was Now That the Buffalo's Gone by Buffy St. Marie, a suitable introduction to the camp of Standing Rock in South Dakota. Our first guest today is Mark Edwards, who spent several months there with you, Pat. So I'll ask you to explore those memories. I believe you actually drove out together.
Okay, well, actually, we drove out separately. But I came bringing a Vietnam vet with me because there had been a call go out from the camp asking for veterans to come and assist at the camp. Mm-hmm. And so I drove out my friend Bruce, mm-hmm. and we met Pat out there.
And I had gone out at Thanksgiving in 2016, spent Thanksgiving there, and that's when I learned of the veterans gathering that was coordinated by General Wesley Clark's son, Wesley Clark Jr. So that was kind of the inspiration to attend. And we had all been hearing about and things that were unfolding at Standing Rock. So it was a chance to kind of see the lay of the land, if you will.
Well, I know we're going to talk to Wally later, but I remember his call. He was like the Paul Revere for Iowa in 2014 there at the end. And we had a big meeting in Ames and filled the auditorium. And that was kind of the first thing about the pipeline coming. And then Standing Rock was like the culmination of us all coming together in a bigger picture outside mm-hmm. of Iowa.
Yeah, let's discuss that 2014 gathering and kind of go from there, Mark.
Well, it was quite interesting because Wally had heard a rumor, and he can maybe go into that, but about the pipeline coming. And so various people within the community in Ames called a meeting. Carolyn Ratzenberger was there, I remember. Like I say, the auditorium was packed. Realized the scale of this coming.
And Wally was the attorney for the Sierra Club and kind of like performing a very key role in the functioning of
Absolutely.
That group.
For me, that was the tie-in because I immediately thought about where I lived, and I lived right over by the Des Moines River. And when we heard it was going to cross the river, and that was kind of the big part of the controversy was in their permits was crossing those major rivers because we were very concerned about what would a spill mean for that. And that's exactly what Standing Rock symbolized on a big scale because they're talking about the Missouri River, which is, you know, going into the Mississippi River. And that's two-thirds of the, you know, the states in America it's going to affect that water.
And so, not only did it approach Standing Rock south of the town, it earlier, and help refresh my memory, what was the town that they did not want to go north of the town because of spill might affect the town. So they went south of the town. That affected right. the Standing Rock Reservation. But what's the town up there?
Was it Bismarck?
Bismarck.
Read it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite a – we've learned a lot, haven't we, over the time of how things work? Because it was interesting for me is my dad used to take me up there fishing in that very area. So I had some connection back there to that area. And the big part was the Native Americans talking about, well, before the dam came, they displaced all these people, made them move. Leave that area, which was their homeland, for that lake to go in. So,
and just a few years later, they're contaminating the lake.
Yeah.
Well, and so as the pipeline was evolving, it was coming. There seemed to be some hearings with the Iowa Utilities Board. Let's explore some of that, how that framework unfolded at that first meeting in 2014.
Boy, I guess I became involved right away on the public meeting. They had one in Des Moines, and that's when the public first started getting involved on the IUB level and started going, well, wait a minute, their IUB is the oversight for Iowa, just like the Corps of Engineers would be the oversight on the national level. And so we all turned our attention to that, thinking, well, we need to educate them. So they had to start having public meetings at that point. And so that's where the public really became involved. And that's when information really started coming out. So, you know, I thought that was a big turning point. We all started realizing the scope of this was, you know, so immense and the effect that it could have. It was still beyond comprehension.
Yeah, I believe it was 18 different counties stretching from far northwest Iowa, diagonally across the state to far southeast Iowa, and essentially almost impacting the majority of the watersheds that come through Iowa.
Well, yeah, even that Des Moines River, you know, drains two-thirds of Iowa right there, just the one river crossing, let alone the Missouri and the Mississippi watersheds.
Yeah. Well, so maybe refresh me somewhat on the during those public meetings, the Iowa Utilities Board, of which there are three members, were somewhat mandated to have these public hearings. What was your impression of the acceptance or the concerns in the makeup of the crowds that were attending these public meetings?
Well, that was the exciting part of all the different people it brought together. And I remember, you know, climate was just beginning to become a larger topic. And I remember one of the people on the IUB being a climate denier. He didn't believe in global climate change and things like that. And so that kind of set off some flags immediately. And then as the more we learned about their backgrounds, you know, the one was a lawyer, two were Republicans, you know, so you could kind of see a developing history of how that level of oversight was working. And it was clear that they didn't have the background to really evaluate the scope of this project. So.
Yet the project did move forward.
yes. Yeah.
So by...
There was another thing about those hearings. Their labor was always represented. And these were the guys who were going to be working on the pipeline. And they gave them, I mean, often there would be a time for a statement against the pipeline, and then they would come about how it meant their jobs, it was so important for labor. And they really played that hard.
Yeah, I have a story related to that really well, that my wife was outside talking to one of them at the big public meeting in Des Moines, or in Boone, and they invited her over to eat at the chow where they're feeding them all. They paid them all to come, and he was telling the story about he was in a union fighting the very oil company for worker conditions down at the refinery. So it wasn't, you know, they flew all these people in to have them testify. It was kind of a rigged game from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, so it did move forward, and there was quite a bit of resistance at Standing Rock. And do you want to explore what was in your heart at that time as far as going up there, Mark Edwards?
Well, Pat, and you were a part of that. I mean, I drove a friend, Bruce, we went together, longtime friends from back, you know, beginning college, and then you were a longtime friend. And so, you know, there are three of us. I remember standing there that day, and, you know, it's snow, it's cold, it's early December. You know, there have been these violent confrontations already. I mean, that's what really brought people in that realized the repression that was coming down on protesting this. And so there we're standing there in that sun on my face, and I remember hearing that sound roll down the hill. We'd been up kind of by the council area, and then we'd kind of went down. We'd had our nonviolent training and getting ready for the day. And to hear that sound, and it was, what was that sound? It was a celebration, a whoopee, a water is life just reverberated through that whole camp. It was just incredible, the sound, I remember. And that was a celebration of, you know, the ruling that they denied the permit for a while, and we're going to reevaluate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was attending part of that nonviolent action of holding mirrors. We had full-length mirrors, and of which somebody had donated, to take up to the, I guess, the National Guard, or basically the force that was there to resist the Standing Rock numbers, and there were, I think, 10,000 people there, but not that many mirrors. But the roar went up. The permit had been denied, and since we still had the mirrors, and this is kind of an interesting visual to kind of impart on people, that we realized that, well, we have these mirrors, so we directed them. Each of us put the mirror over our head, so it was like flashing upward, and they had some drones, and then we embarked on going throughout the camp for about the next 45 minutes. And for an old guy, I remember thinking, well, this 45 minutes ago, this was a great idea. I'm getting kind of tired holding this mirror over my head, but still we persevered. But the metaphor, what we were trying to hope a viewer would envision, was the glistening of the, and the reflections of the mirrors would be similar to the water of life that had become essentially the trademark of the whole gathering. Things did change. There was a mood, elevation of the spirit of the camp, it seemed, at that time.
the mood going from that repression and violence and fear and all that base to that celebration was just, what a switch in a matter of minutes. I mean, it was just like that wave rolled over you, and it was just such a wonderful feeling. I just remember that, which kind of symbolizes this whole thing of the up and down.
The next day, I mentioned General Wesley Clark. His son, Wesley Clark Jr., had you know, the veterans, of which there was quite a contingency, and met with a tribal elder, Chief Leonard Crowdog, and he apologized. These are the words of Captain Wesley Clark Jr., quote, "We came, we fought you, we took your land, we signed treaties that we broke, we stole minerals from your sacred hills, we blasted the faces of our presidents onto your sacred mountain, and we took still more land. And then we took your children. And then we tried to take your language. We tried to eliminate your language that God gave you and that the Creator gave you. We didn't respect you. We polluted your earth. We've hurt you in so many ways, and we've come to say that we are sorry. We are at your service, and we beg for your forgiveness." To which Leonard Crowdog responded, he's a Lakota spiritual leader. He placed his hand upon Clark's head. He said, "We are Lakota sovereign nation. We were a nation, and we're still a nation," he said. "We have a language to speak. We have persevered. We have preserved the caretaker position. We do not own the land. The land owns us." Maybe those words should be put on a rock somewhere, you know, in our nation's capital, along some, you know, as far as what happened December 5th, 2016.
That was a life-changing event, I felt.
Then it was time to leave camp. It was wintertime. There's quite a scene, I think, that was occurred on the Sunday with Chief Arville Looking Horse. There were a lot of horsemen kind of moving through a blizzarded area. It's like when Native people determine something's going to happen on the timeline, it happens, whatever the weather may be. And yeah, I think they knew the resistance would go on. But yeah, the Dakota Access, it's been active, and thank goodness there hasn't been any spills at this point. But
another form of pipeline resistance has been taking place in Iowa. Here's a voice reporting that action.
I'm calling Keith Puntney, who had a lawsuit against the Dakota Access Pipeline for going through his land. Could you describe your original lawsuit?
Well, there were actually two lawsuits. The first one involved the Iowa Utility Board hearing that was back in December of 2015, and that concerned the actual granting of the permit. They granted the permit. Dakota Access then went through eminent domain against those of us who refused to sign voluntary easements. And I and others then joined to try and get the district court to stay the proceedings, which refused to do. And then we appealed the district court ruling directly to the Iowa Supreme Court. That hearing and the Iowa Supreme Court case ended with our Supreme Court basically saying two things. One, the pipe's in the ground, so the issue is moot. And the second one was the permit was granted, and it was granted under the authority of the Iowa Utility Board, and they basically okayed the granting of the permit. Subsequent to that case and that decision, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case that came out called the Kinnick case. And the Kinnick case dealt with a part of the Irish Supreme Court that was the U.S. Constitution. And, of course, Irish Supreme Court only considered the state constitution issues in terms of that. So we actually had a pro bono law firm out in Los Angeles that said, well, let's take this case up to the U.S. Supreme Court and see what they will do. We thought we had a really, really good case because there are a number of different contrary opinions in several courts of appeals. Unfortunately, our case got tied up in the Supreme Court docket. We were one of the cases that they basically decided not to take to oral hearing after all of the briefing and everything else. And of course, during this same time, never really got a full hearing. It was kicked back and the decision basically stood as granted by the Iowa Utility Board. 2 years later, Dakota Access folks came back in 2019 to the four states that were involved, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois, and said, well, we've decided we want to double the oil flows. They were doubling their oil flows from 570,000 barrels a day to 1,100,000 barrels a day, and there's 42 gallons in a barrel, so that's the equivalent of 23 million gallons going to 46 million gallons every day through the pipe. So they figured out that we were likely to take them all the way back up through the court system on this proposal. Secondly, the Iowa Utility Board forced them to go through a contested hearing process, you know, and in the first case before the permit was granted. And they were concerned that we were going to take this back through a contested hearing process again. And they had been treated better both in the Dakotas and over in Illinois by, you know, those respective groups. So their plan was to basically bypass Iowa because since they were only making pumping changes or putting in larger pumps, they didn't think they needed to do anything in Iowa, not even notify the Iowa Utility Board of what they were proposing to do, and that all they would have to do was get approval in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Illinois, which they thought was a done deal. Didn't turn out quite that way. North Dakota and South Dakota rubber stamped everything because they get a lot of revenue from the oil extraction. So they pretty much got rubber stamped in the Dakotas. When it got to Iowa, they just sent a letter and said, well, we just want to let you know that we're doing some changes to the pumping station, but it doesn't change the permit or in any way, you know, change where the pipe is or how it's laid or require additional land or anything. So we're just notifying you that we're making some changes at the pumping station.
That was Keith Putney with his version of the done deal that Energy Transfer Partners anticipated as it planned to double the amount of oil to be pumped in the Dakota Access Pipeline from North Dakota and South Dakota through Iowa and Illinois. As he said, it didn't work out that way. We now have with us Wally Taylor, the Iowa Sierra Club lawyer, who was responsible for the fight the company had gotten through Iowa. He'll also tell us the barriers the pipeline still has to face in Illinois and on Wall Street.
And Wally Taylor, we're glad you're able to join us today. I know our listeners must be confused by the fragments of information we're getting. Was the decision by the Army Corps of Engineers to review the environmental impact statement, the victory the first reports claimed?
Partially. My understanding of what's happened in North Dakota is that the Standing Rock Sioux tribe sued, no pun intended, the Corps of Engineers for not adequately evaluating the impact where the pipeline would cross the Missouri River. Initially, the federal court judge said that the tribe was correct, that the environmental impact statement was not done correctly, sent it back, but for some strange reason said that Dakota Access could go ahead and build the pipeline anyway. And that's been, a couple of years ago. So the Corps of Engineers redid their environmental impact statement, and the tribe took them back to court, and the judge again said the Corps of Engineers didn't do it right, so sent it back again. But still, the pipeline is in the ground, and it's still transporting oil. Mm-hmm. So the Corps has to go back and dot the I's and cross the T's, and I believe eventually the Corps of Engineers will get it right, and everything will be a memory. What people need to understand is that the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the law that requires environmental impact statements, is really a pretty weak law. The courts have said it's only procedural. As long as the agency puts together some paper and makes it look like good science, that's all they have to do.
Mm-hmm. Are there any
faulty environmental impact statement can never stop a project.
I see. Are there any timelines or deadlines or dates in the when these decisions might be rendered?
First of all, there's the North Dakota Public Utility Commission decision that came down, a couple of months or so ago, mm-hmm. approving the expansion of the pipeline. As you said a few moments ago, what Dakota Access wants to do now is essentially double the volume of oil going through the pipeline. The original maximum that they had said they were going to put through the pipeline was 570,000 barrels per day. Now they want to go up to 1.1 million barrels a day, which, if my math is correct, I'm not great at math, but that's about a doubling. And the concern is that the pipeline is not designed to handle that increased volume. But the North Dakota Public Utility Commission, which is a state agency there, like our utilities board, said everything was fine, and Dakota Access got permits from them to increase the volume. In Iowa, there's no real hard and fast rule that says Dakota Access had to get an amended permit. And in fact, they took the position they didn't have to. We objected to that. And at that time, at least, the utilities board said, yes, you do have to get an amended permit, because the original permit was issued on the assertion or condition stated by Dakota Access at that time that 570,000 barrels per day would be the maximum. And so, because of the increased volume, the board said you have to get an amended permit. So then Dakota Access requested a waiver of the requirement for an evidentiary hearing on an amended permit. And we objected to that, and we had two experts who said that there are real concerns about increasing the volume that much, that you're putting stress on the pipeline. If there is a rupture, it's going to be a significant amount of increased damage from that spill as opposed to the original volume going through the pipeline, and that the drag reducing agent, which Dakota Access claimed would allow them to put this additional volume through without any additional pressure, which it seems like a violation of the law of physics, but they claimed that. But our experts said, well, no, that may not be right. You have to really do some testing to find out if that's a true statement or not. So we felt we had enough to justify a hearing. So then the utilities board said, well, no, all they're really going to do is just increase the power of the pumping station. They're really not going to do anything to the pipeline. And so they granted the waiver of the hearing and issued the amended permit, which seems to me to be an exact reversal of what they had said when they said they needed an amended permit, because the need for the amended permit was based on the increased volume, not the modifications to the pumping station.
In a practical sense, when I think of oil, you think of lubricant. When you think of doubling capacity, you used a term that there's a solution within that crude that makes it possible to not wear out these pipes? Do I understand that correctly? Is there?
That's what they claimed, that they were going to put in what's called a drag-reducing agent.
Oh, drag-reducing, yeah.
Pipeline, or added to the oil.
So if a drag-reducing agent is necessary, that would kind of indicate that there is drag occurring. And when things are dragging and you double capacity, I have a hard time following the physics of exactly what their arguments are trying to justify.
College, but it's not my specialty.
Well,
And then in Illinois, they have a different situation because the Illinois law actually required them absolutely to get an amended permit and to have a hearing. So they had an evidentiary hearing back in early March, I believe it was, and a couple of the allegations that were made by the Sierra Club and a group of landowners there. I was not involved personally, but I've kept track of what's happening there. Two of the contentions were the same ones that we've raised here about the increased risk from putting that much more oil through the pipeline. And the other one was that the shippers who claim to have the contracts that required this increased volume are actually what they call affiliates of Dakota Access, or Dakota Access's parent company, Energy Transfer. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has said that that may very well be an illegal arrangement, to have your own affiliates be the alleged shipper and creating the what amounts to a self-induced need for the pipeline. And so those are the issues. The Illinois Public Utility Commission has not yet issued a ruling on that case.
Yeah. Well, and I understand there's, the oil market has kind of been down. Are you aware of any bankruptcies or things that might be shifting financially with these large oil operations?
I've not heard anything specific, but my understanding is there's certainly a lot of concern, although the price is going up a little bit now. Throughout this whole thing, I've sort of kept track of what's happening with the oil industry and the price of oil and so on, and you'd go nuts if that was your job.
Yeah,
to keep track of that, because it just varies from day to day, these people are speculating. It's just hard to know.
Well, do you have any other points, or Mark Edwards? Is there anything else needs to be included here before we wrap this up?
I think of the spill thing, it's not if, it's when the spill. And that's always been the premise I've worked from. And if there is a spill, and with the doubled volume or the lubricant in the pipe, whatever condition is, if the spill happens, it's going to be catastrophic. You don't clean up something of that scale. Mm-hmm. And that's where I look at it from.
And the people who would clean it up are several states away. It would take them a couple of days to get there. The only local involvement from first responders is to keep off the area so nobody can get in. But they're not doing any cleanup or any remediation or any protection. The point I would make, Pat, if I can, is that I think what all of this shows is that elections have consequences. We need state legislators who pass good laws. We need governors who make good appointments to boards and commissions, who make good appointments to the judiciary. So if you think that you can just stay home and not do anything on election day, you're wrong.
Well, no, thank you, Wally Taylor. The Iowa Sierra Club lawyer who's been in the thick of the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline from their first request for their first permit Before we leave this COVID-19 response program, we need to report the news from Indian country. With tribal businesses halted in the peril, the economic impact of COVID-19 on the native communities could have been devastating, said Joseph Kahl, the Ford Foundation professor of international economy at Harvard Kennedy School. This is his quote. There is not a single Indian casino in the United States open today, and all the tribal businesses are closed. Native American tribes' tax base have been cut literally to zero, and tribal governments don't have money to run the health care or child protection services. While state and local governments are also in trouble, at least they have a tax base. But tribes are really struggling because their tax base has been wiped out. That, in addition to the fact that they have a far higher rate of COVID-19 in their population on the tribes than the general population. But speaking of voting, there will be another forum presented by the League of Women Voters for the primary for State Senate District 29. Jerry Bain is retiring, and he has several Republican candidates who are vying for his seat. And also, the Ames Patriotic Council has an announcement for this year's Memorial Day. The parade and ceremony will be postponed until fall, but Memorial Day is a federal holiday on which May 25th is this year. And even though the public will not gather publicly in person outside in an auditorium on May 25th, the Ames Patriotic Council invites you to join a memorial presentation during KHOI's local talk when we will recognize people of service. There will also be a reading of the names of Ames veterans who have become deceased between May 2019 and May 2020. The vision of the Patriotic Council is indeed to broaden the commemoration this year to all those who have worn a uniform and served during the COVID crisis. The list is long. Nurses, doctors, and other hospital and healthcare workers, police, firefighters, and emergency response workers, postal workers, UPS, FedEx, and other delivery drivers, and all those who deliver our food, grocery clerks, and sanitation workers, and so many more. All these and all the others on the front lines of the current fight have risked and sacrificed, and too many have died.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people's stories and events in Central Iowa. I've been one of your hosts, Pat Schlarba, with Susan Franson. Today's guests were Mark Edwards, Keith Putney, Carolyn Raffensperger, and Wally Taylor. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon today, Local Talk will present a special program from the Ames Public Library to brighten your spirits and those of any children who might be living with you. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you've heard was Now That the Buffalo Is Gone by Bucky St. Marie from the album It's My Way. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again
on the radio.
On the radio.
Lucy Martin, Story County Auditor and Commissioner of Elections, reminds eligible residents of important deadlines for the upcoming June 2nd primary election. Friday, May 22nd, is the deadline to pre-register to vote for the upcoming primary election. Voter registration forms must be received by the auditor's office by 5 p.m. Friday, May 22nd is also the deadline to request a mailed absentee ballot for the primary election. Both voter registration and absentee ballot request forms must be received in the auditor's office by 5 p.m. on Friday, May 22nd. Both types of forms may be placed in the drop box in the parking lot of the Story County Administration Building at 900 6th Street, Nevada. And don't forget the census. People are strongly encouraged to respond promptly to the 2020 census using the ID number included in the questionnaire packet. Responding with a census ID or the paper questionnaire helps ensure the best count of your community. People can respond online, by phone, or by using the paper form in the packet.